March 7th, 1987, Van Nuys, 7:45 p.m. We finished You're All I Need, the song Tommy and I were working on yesterday. I guess it's a take on Taxi Driver in the sense that if you really love somebody, you would kill them so nobody else can have them, right? The blade of my knife faced away from your heart. Those last few nights, it turned and sliced you apart. This love that I tell now feels lonely as hell from this padded prison cell. So many times I said, you'd only be mine. I gave my blood and my tears, and I loved you cyanide. When you took my lips, I took your breath. Sometimes love's better off dead. You're all I need, make you only mine. I loved you, so I set you free. I had to take your life. You're all I need, you're all I need. And I loved you, but you didn't love me. Laid out cold, now we're both alone. But killing you helped me keep you home. I guess it was bad, 'cause love can get sad. But we finally made the news. Tied up smiling, I thought you were happy. Never opened your eyes, I thought you were napping. I got so much to learn about love in this world, but we finally made the news. You're all I need, make you only mine. I love you so, so I put you to sleep. I mean, I don't think I can ever really love anybody, but murder's not out of the question. Considering that this fucking whore was fucking somebody else while I was out on tour. How dare she cheat on me? So today Vince sang the vocals and I plan on hand delivering the cassette to Nicole tonight to see if she gets the joke. If it is a joke. 2 a.m. Just got back from Nicole's house. It went like a dream. When I got there, she looked kind of nervous, but I sat down with her and said, you know, we really had a nice relationship, but we've had hard times, so I've written a song for you about our time together. Nicole looked real emotional and reminded me that the last time we had talked, I told her I was going to slit her throat. I'd forgotten that. I told her that I've changed. I put the song on and Nicole looked touched as the beautiful piano kicked in. And then I sat there hiding my smile as the lyrics started to flow. When Vince sang You're All I Need, I could see her thinking, that's Jack's song. Then when the song ended, she just looked at me and said, you're a fucking asshole, and you've always been an asshole. Nice. I told her she could keep the cassette, and as I walked out, I said, how's Jack doing anyway? She said I had no idea what I was talking about. I said, tell Jack to kiss his knees goodbye. When I got home that night, I phoned some local bikers and hired them. Their job was to wait in the bushes outside the TV studio and break Jack Wagner's kneecaps. Then tell him Nikki Sixx sends his love.
Wayne Isham. I shot Motley's video for You're All I Need, but at the time I never made the connection that Nikki saw the song as partly about him and Nicole. Nikki was so paranoid, but his fears of her betraying him were totally unfounded. Nicole was a great girl with a real cool smile, but Nikki took her down to the depths. Every time you saw her, you could see she was just being sucked into this vortex. It was too bad because she was a real nice person. Taking the song to play it to Nicole is such a Nikki thing to do. He would enjoy doing it as well. He always had the devil's wise-ass smile in his eyes. I guess that's why he always wore sunglasses.
March 8th, 1987, Van Nuys, 3:50 p.m. Nicole just phoned me screaming and crying and telling me that I was a son of a bitch for getting Jack's legs broken. I told her I had no idea what she was talking about, but it's fucking cool. This was a truly bizarre eventuality. Shortly after Nicole phoned, my contact called and apologized, saying that they hadn't been able to get to Jack. I was baffled until it came on local news. By pure coincidence, Wagner had fallen over during filming that day and broken his knee on the soundstage. My head was so messed up, I thought it was divine retribution. March 9th, 1987, Van Nuys. 11:30 p.m. I did the stupidest fucking thing today. I still can't believe I did it. I called up Rick Nielsen to say hi. When he picked up the phone, I asked him to wait a minute. Then I went and drank a whole bottle of water, shot some blow, puked down the jacuzzi before I picked up the phone to talk to him. Rick had just waited the whole time. I must have sounded fucked because he asked me if I was okay and if I was using. I said I hadn't touched drugs in months. Why do I do these things? What is fucking wrong with me? Rick Nielsen from Cheap Trick was an early hero of mine. I can't quite believe I was so fucked up that I phoned him, then made him wait while I shot up and puked before I talked to him. It's even harder to believe that I thought he wouldn't notice me behaving in this bizarre manner.
Rick Nielsen. Nicky would sometimes call me at home and say he was having trouble. He'd call and say he was high and didn't want to be. Or he'd tell me he was clean and I would know that he wasn't because I would hear it in his voice. I'd tell him, "You can lie to your mom or your girlfriend or the priest, but don't lie to me." I used to tell him that he could tell me about anything. That he was doing drugs or screwing a girl, that his dick was gonna fall off. A friend tells you the truth. That your breath stinks and you need a bath. An enemy tells you that you look great and you shouldn't change a thing. I do remember one time Nicky calling, then going away from the phone for minutes. I figured he was just doing a line of blow. I had no idea about shooting up. I wasn't around that kind of stuff. Then he came back on the phone and could hardly talk, but he was telling me he hadn't done anything. It takes a fool to know a fool, and man, I heard a fool. If Nicky called me when he was making no sense, I would say that I had to go, but he was often pretty lucid. I was flattered he wanted to talk to me, even if he was talking bullshit. Who else can a musician call? He calls his peers. He can't tell the other guys in the band he's in trouble because they'll tell the manager. Sometimes he'd call me all excited, saying he wanted to get together and write, and I would say, "Sure, when?" Then he would get all vague. I'd tell him, "Be honest, try to do AA, take one day at a time," but he was pretty stubborn. Before he was on junk, Nicky Six was a big teddy bear with a nice smile. He could barely play the bass, mind you, but that never stopped Gene Simmons. I wanted to help him, but I guess ultimately you can only slay the dragon yourself. All that I could do was help him sharpen his sword if he needed me to.
March 11th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. I've been working on a little theory I call my hygiene maintenance theory. Basically, it's very simple. One, why take a shower if you're only going to get dirty again? Two, why make your bed if you're only going to sleep in it again? And three, why get sober if you're only going to get drunk again? Showering is something you only have to do when the people around you can't stand the stink. The only reason to be sober is if you have to do something. And when I've got a few days off at home, neither of those situations apply. March 12th, 1987, Van Nuys, 3:10 a.m. Tonight I realized something that terrified me. I was in my closet, worried that I could hear voices in the walls. Then I went to lock all my doors at the security box, and I realized that I only need to push a button to talk to Westech. Who is to say that they can't hear me, whether I push the button or not? Who is to say they haven't got fucking secret cameras that can see me? When I was high on cocaine, Westech security was the bane of my life, and I was certainly the bane of theirs. They were a security company who had fitted all the alarms on my house, and I also had a panic button that I could push to alert them in case of intruders. When I was shooting or freebasing coke, I invariably thought there were SWAT teams on the roof, stormtroopers in the garden, and I often ended up phoning Westech. Then, when I got equally convinced that my security company was spying on me, it made our relationship very strained, to say the least. March 13th, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:20 a.m. Pete and I went down to the cat house tonight. I felt pretty cool. Wore my new tailored jacket for the first time, with the big Nazi armband on the arm. The Nazis may have been sick fucks, but they sure looked cool. Ricky showed us straight into the VIP bar, and Pete and I hung out in the corner checking out the chicks. I asked Ricky to show me where the VIP bathroom was. He took me down there. I asked him if he had a bottle cap for some blow. Ricky looked surprised, but he got me a bottle cap and I pulled out my baggie from my boot, and I shot up in the toilet. When I came out of the stall, Ricky's eyes were wide open. He looked disgusted. Fuck, he'll get over it. March 15th, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:30 a.m. It's getting to the point where life only makes sense to me when I'm here, in my closet. People don't make sense to me. I have no comfort zone. I don't know how to live. I feel like an alien. When people talk to me, I can't hear them. When I go places, I feel alone. I see messages in the TV shows. I hear things other people don't hear. I decipher what they say wrong. Am I insane? Sometimes it seems like suicide is the only option.
Tommy Lee. I only realized how uncomfortable Six was in his own skin when I saw him sober. If he was sober, he would not leave his house. He was so antisocial that he couldn't be around people for more than 2 minutes. A sober Nikki Six would never enter a room full of strangers. No fucking chance. I would look at him and see his face scrunch up, and I could see he was sweating and thinking, I've got to get out of here. I don't know how to act or what to say. I could see it all over him, and I predicted myself, just watch, Six will be out of here in 1 minute. When he was high, he was fine with everybody, but as soon as he sobered up, he had major issues with being around people.
March 16th, 1987, Van Nuys, 7:35 p.m. Having no needles left when you're jonesing is the worst thing in the world. Last night I was shooting up with my last syringe and it broke. The needle snapped right in two. I was dying for the fix, so I was just trying to cram the broken stub into my fucking vein, gouging and ripping at my skin, trying to force it in. The blood was spurting all over my closet, and I was just slamming the drugs any place under my skin, praying that they would take the pain away. Thank God they did.
Doc McGee. By this stage, Nikki wasn't taking heroin to get high. He was taking it to try to stay normal. That's the way it is with junkies after a while. They use it in order to not get sick. It takes away the withdrawal symptoms, the aches and the pains, and it's clear to me now that Nikki was taking heroin to stay out of the pain that he was in every day of his life.
March 17th, 1987. Van Nuys, 3:40 a.m. Found myself thinking about Lita today. We were pretty cool together. Maybe if I met her later in life, we would have worked out, but I wasn't ready for settling down back then. But we had some good times. When I met her just last December, I could see she was shocked at the state I was in. Maybe I was too, but she really never said anything. For some reason, people hardly ever do. They can all see how strung out I am. Why don't they fucking say something? I met Lita Ford in 1982 at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. She'd walked up, introduced herself by putting a half a Quaalude on my tongue, and in a matter of days, we were living together. But back then, I was in full-on party animal mode, and after Motley Crue finished the Shout at the Devil tour, I moved out from her place to live with Robin Crosby from Rat. We met up again just before Christmas in 1986 when I wrote a song called Falling In and Out of Love to go on her album, and she was horrified at my condition. I was waif thin, out of my mind, doing drugs nonstop, snorting off the piano as we were trying to write. I'd taken things much further than she had ever dreamed, and she felt she didn't know me anymore. Lita liked to party, sure, but I'd become a full-blown addict. March 19th, 1987, Van Nuys, 1:15 a.m. I just took a shit and realized yet again I haven't bought toilet paper in weeks. Ode to Mom. I woke up to the sound of screaming in my head. There was a dead body lying next to me in bed. A knife had so neatly cut out her heart, ripped and tore and shredded it apart. I hadn't had a drink, hadn't left the house, so I was scared half to death trying to figure this out. I tried to scream, but my words came out low. I was drowning in confusion, panic without hope. Then the sound, a blessing, I swear, my alarm going off, waking me from fear. I opened my eyes, a nightmare, I gasped. Then I realized I was holding a knife in my grasp. I get out of bed, following a trail of blood. There lies mother, no heart, but looking good. March 22nd, 1987, Van Nuys, 11:30 a.m. Last night, it happened again. I remember going into my closet and pulling out my Dom Perignon box. I love it when that box is full. Some might see it as opening a casket and peering at death, but to me it's like seeing a hole in the sky with a ray of light from God coming in. When I open that box, I know I'm going to feel good in just a matter of seconds. Then I shot up the coke into my neck, my leg, my arm, or even my cock, and then it started. I knew that West Tech was listening in on me, that they could hear my heart beating, that they had cameras spying on me. I stood with my ear to the security box, not daring to breathe, and I was terrified. Did they have police coming to get me, or the guys with the straitjackets? They know that I'm insane, right? Then I realized I was wrong. West Tech isn't my enemy. They're the ones who can save me from the people outside trying to get in. So I pushed the panic button. Then I didn't know. Had I pushed it, or did I just think I'd done it? So there I was, naked, strung out, a shotgun loaded, knowing people were about to break into my house. Were they coming to save me or to get me? So I quickly flushed my drugs down the toilet and waited for what was about to happen. My biggest decision was this. Do I go quietly or shoot and defend myself? Now I wake up to discover it was just another night of insanity. I didn't press any button and nothing happened, except for I flushed all my fucking drugs down the toilet again. Noon. I hate mornings like today. When I wake up or come down, whichever comes first, and I have these memories of things that I've done that feel like they were on TV or I read them in a book, it's getting harder and harder to know what's real. March 23rd, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. Well, today we finally wrapped up the Girls album. All in all, I think it turned out pretty good. Of course, you always say that when it's your newest album, don't you? We're leaving for New York tomorrow to master the record. Mastering always brings out all the life and sparkle, so I'll reserve judgment until the master to decide whether this is a great Motley Crue record or just a good Motley Crue record. But the fact that we managed to finish a record is amazing to me. Tommy and I flew out first class to New York to master the album. Our engineer and mixer, Dwayne Barron and Pete Purdell, weren't flying out until the next day. So what did Tommy and I do in New York City with the night off to ourselves? We went out to the sickest underground dance club we could find. All was well as far as I was concerned. I was a few thousand miles away from my junk and our album was done. But as usual, the devil wears many masks. He kept on and on in my ear about how we should get some junk. Finally, I set out to find some, only to come back with pockets full of cocaine. Thank God. But of course, none of us slept before mastering the album. March 31st, 1987, Van Nuys, 9:15 p.m. Just got back from mastering the album. I forgot to take you, diary, but if I had, I doubt I would have written anything in you. They say New York is the city that never sleeps. I guess if we did nothing else, we fucking proved that one. I need my bed. April 1987. Does my illness hang off of me like a fucking smell? April 1st, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:40 p.m. I just had a surprise visitor. It was the last thing I expected. Randy Rand turned up at my door out of the blue. I hadn't seen him in months. When I opened the door, his jaw literally fell open in shock, like he'd seen a ghost. He told me that I'd lost 50 pounds since he last seen me. I'm pleased about this, but Randy didn't seem to see it as a good thing. Then when I invited him in, he shook his head and said he had to go. Does my illness hang off me like a fucking smell? I'm waiting for T-Bone to come over. Randy Rand was in a band Autograph who supported us for a few dates on the Theater of Pain tour. I once stole his bass head from a rehearsal room in Hollywood because it sounded better than mine. He's a great guy. He never did bust my chops about it, still to this day. April 2nd, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. I went fishing today with Tommy and Dwayne Barron. We did coke all night until it was time to leave for the lake. We sailed out, then came back for more beers when Doc McGee came to meet us. We were out on the lake playing the Master Girls album over and over on Tommy's little blaster. Doc told us that John Bon Jovi thinks we've written the greatest song of our career. I asked him which one, and he said, "You're All I Need." I asked if John had ever listened to the lyrics, and Doc said, "Why? What's it about?" I snickered and told him. Doc told me I'm an asshole and a sick fuck. Fair comment, I guess. Tommy and I were so high on coke that night that in our minds the tent was flying like a magic carpet ride. We actually believed we were flying through the air around the lake in a tent. I remember Tommy telling me to stare at him and not move. With my hair all in tangles and the shadows from the lantern dancing across my face, he kept imagining that I looked like this wicked witch. He was getting so into it, I remember at one point thinking, okay, who's more insane here? Me for sitting here for hours motionless, or Tommy for having me sit here so he can hallucinate? I don't think we caught any fish that day, but we sure had one hell of a magic carpet ride.
Tommy Lee. Here's a There Goes the Neighborhood memory. Readers, picture this. A packed family campground with kids, bikes, fishing poles, water skis, campfires, etc. Then just when you think it's safe, here comes the badass super stretch limo from hell. It's not something you normally see at any campground you go to, but then again, you never went camping with me and Nikki. I know you're thinking, God, these dudes are so spoiled and that the limo is there to take them home, right? Not! The cocaine has been delivered by limousine. Imagine us crawling out of our dark tent into the daylight to pick up more blow. Not a good look. That poor limo driver ended up making a few more round trips up there to keep our magic carpet ride afloat.
April 4th, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:20 a.m. I think things are looking up. Pete and me have now got porn stars doing our drug runs for us. Lois came over earlier. She's an interesting character. She came in, we had a few beers, and then she said she wanted to show us her video. We said, sure. So she walks over with the VHS tape, sticks it in the machine, and voila. It was eight black guys coming all over her face. Even I was shocked, but Lois is proud of it. She thinks it's some kind of world record. More importantly, Lois has agreed to go down to Watts for us to score some loads. Let's just say it's not the best place for a tattooed white kid to go to score. But after seeing her video, maybe Lois has a special relationship with the dealer down there. Hey, practice makes perfect. These pills are my new favorite drug. I love them. You can't even fucking move on them. Completely comatose. They're like heroin on steroids. I can't wait. Loads were a combo of two different kinds of pills. You took three of one kind and two of the other, and literally in 10 minutes, you were so high you couldn't even stand up. We had a very scientific approach to mixing it with blow to somehow even out the effect enough to at least somehow function. When I was a teenager, we used to take elephant tranquilizers. The effects were similar. 3:30 p.m. After Lois got back with the loads last night, things got kind of warped. When she came back, she had some other girl with her. I recognized her from some porn movies Pete had. I don't remember what her name was. Did I even know it? But she left a few minutes ago. Anyway, after I took a second dose and not enough cocaine to bring me out of my stupor, this girl decided she was going to spend the night with me. Who was I to argue? The only problem was my dick didn't seem to be aware that she was there. She kept asking me what was wrong, and I was so out of it that I thought she meant what was wrong in the world, so I started talking about global poverty and shit. I'm not surprised she left. I suspect she won't be coming back. April 5th, 1987. Van Nuys, 1:45 a.m. Went to the bookstore today and got some cool books on performance art. I also got a book my grandmother sent me to read when I was 17 years old called Autobiography of a Yogi. April 6, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:40 a.m. Today I was thinking about coming back from Tommy's wedding last year and finding that letter from Chuck Shapiro telling me that I would go bankrupt if I carried on getting wasted at the rate I was. Fuck, that I still am. The funny thing is, even if I was broke and kicked out of the band, and all I had was a room like this closet and enough gear to stay under the warm blanket, forget Motley and the fans, forget the music even, I think I could be happy, I think. Chuck Shapiro was the band's accountant. On the day in 1986 that Nicole and I got back from Tommy's wedding, Chuck left me a hand-delivered note. It read, "You've been spending $5,000 a day. 5,000 times 7 is $35,000 per week. Per month, that's $140,000. In exactly 11 months, you'll be completely broke, if not dead." This was a quite chastening note, so obviously I did the only thing I could do in the circumstance and ignored it completely. Steven Tyler once told me he didn't think he would ever be off heroin. At this point in my life, I remember thinking the same thing. The feeling of completely giving in to your demons is hopeless, but when you can't climb your way out of such a hole, you tend to crouch down and call it home. April 7th, 1987, Van Nuys, 2:30 a.m. Jason's coming over with some real pure China white rather than usual Persian. Persian's okay, but you have that whole routine with the lemons and the extra cotton. China cooks up clean, dissolves so much easier, and when I put it in a syringe with some coke, man, that's the fast track to heaven. The thing about China is it looks like coke, and you can snort it easy. Sure, you can snort Persian, but it kind of stinks like dirt, and it's a dead giveaway snorting anything brown. So nobody knows you're snorting heroin. They assume it's something harmless, like coke. I hope he doesn't bring his damn girlfriend. She sometimes will be talking as I nod off, and when I come to, she's still talking. It's usually about her, so I can jump in where I was before, not caring. There were such different levels of addiction during this year. Sometimes I felt I had it under control and I was just having fun. Unfortunately, the fun never lasted. If you're going to play with the dragon, you're eventually going to get burned.
Bob Michaels. Sometimes Nicky would take heroin really openly around me and ask me to take it with him. At other times, he was real sneaky. He would go to the bathroom, shoot up, puke, then walk back out and sit by me to watch a movie. The whole thing would take 90 seconds, and I would have no idea he had done it. Nicky was a very good actor.
April 8th, 1987, Van Nuys, 11 p.m. So here I sat, alone again, needle in my arm, playing the fucking victim yet again. Or is it the martyr? As much as I love my band, I also hate them, because they are with the people that love them. I don't understand why. As big as my heart is, I'm alone. Maybe I just choose to be this way. Maybe I don't have a choice. Maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm just asking myself questions to hear myself talk. April 9th, 1987, 3 a.m. How could my parents treat me the way they did? How could my father just vanish and not care about the son that he had brought onto the earth? How could my mother love me, or say she loves me, then send me away for months and years at a time, every time she got herself some new fucking boyfriend? I don't have a mother, I don't have a father, don't have a friend, and they made me the way I am. They made me like this.
Bob Timmons. In my opinion, Nicky Six was suffering from depression during the time of his addiction. There was a lot of sadness. He told me many times that he felt people wanted to be around him only because he was famous, not because of who he was. Addictions are just symptoms of underlying issues, and in my view, Nicky self-medicated the emotional pain of his childhood and being away from his mother a lot through drug use. What did he want? Ultimately, he wanted to be able to create love for himself as a person.
11 p.m. Jesus, it's such a hassle to go out nowadays. I can't walk down the street or go to the store without being surrounded by fans, wanting to talk or wanting my autograph or to come home with me. I mean, I love our fans, but fuck. I'm going to go back to the bookstore because I think I might have depression. Maybe something there can help me. I can't control my moods. I feel like I'm coming apart at the seams, even when I'm not on drugs. If only they knew. It seems I'm always falling apart. Always falling apart at the seams. April 10th, 1987. Van Nuys. 5 a.m. I pushed the panic button again tonight. It wasn't my fault. Every time I dared to peer out of my closet, I could see faces at the window, and I heard voices at the door. It's probably 50 feet from the closet to the security box, but it took me an hour of shaking to run there. I felt like I had to run the length of a football field. Then when Westech arrived, I wouldn't let them in. I just kept shouting at them through the door to get away from my fucking house, or I would shoot them. Eventually, they went away. Thank God I had a little junk to bring me down.
Doug Thaler. It was about this time that I called Nikki at home one day. He could never wait to get off the phone, and on this particular occasion, he told me after about a minute, "Well, I've got to go now." I asked him why, and he said, "Doug, there are Mexicans carrying guns climbing over my fence."
3:15 p.m. Doc McGee just phoned. He says he's had a call from Westech security about last night. Their guy claimed that when he showed up there, I was naked and waving a shotgun at him and accusing him of bugging my house. Seems they're worried about their personal safety and threatening to cancel our contract. Luckily, Doc talked them down and smoothed things over. That's what a good manager's for, right?
Doc McGee. Nikki was always seeing Mexicans and midgets running around his fucking house. His blow paranoia was totally out of control. I would get calls from Westech saying he had set all of his alarms off and was in the house refusing to answer the door. Or the police department would call me because Nikki's neighbor had phoned them to report that Nikki was crawling around in his garden in the middle of the night with a shotgun. It would be bad enough if it happened once, but this shit was going on at least twice a week.
April 12, 1987. Van Nuys, 3:15 a.m. Went around to some strip bars with T-Bone and Wayne to scout out locations for the Girls, Girls, Girls video. I think this one is going to be good. Wayne gets where we come from. It's just a shame that that bastard steals our ideas for Bon fucking Jovi.
Wayne Isham. I shot a lot of videos with Motley, but I first met them way before I was a director. When I was a stage manager at the A&M Soundstage in L.A., they came in to film the Shout of the Devil video. I had a little office next to the dressing room and could hear them complaining to each other that they needed a drink before they started shooting. I told them I had some Jack, and they all came stomping into my office with their huge hair and platform boots and drank it all. My first Motley video was smoking in the boys' room right at the start of my career. I met Nikki and Tommy and talked through the shoot the night before. Then they said, "Okay, dude, let's go out." I was saying, "No, no, we have to work tomorrow." And Nikki said, "Are you some sort of pussy?" They had this real, enthusiasm for life. We all partied so hard back then, drank so hard, and did so much blow. I guess we felt indestructible. Nikki never seemed worse than anyone else. Although when we made the Home Sweet Home video, there were a couple of times he had to be carried on and off the set for his close-ups. That was the first time I thought, are you rocking this or is it rocking you? Nikki was a real Jekyll and Hyde character. One minute he would be coherent, friendly, and articulate. The next he'd be out of it and a real sardonic wise-ass and insulting motherfucker. He had this positive energy, then he just turned the page and be a real asshole, and there was a real meanness in the way he chastised me. Nikki hated Bon Jovi, and he was always busting my balls and calling me a traitor for working with John. He accused me of selling out by making Bon Jovi videos and told me I was ripping off Motley's style. Well, pardon me, but I thought that was a universal style, not just Motley's. He'd always be in my face saying, "Fuck you," and one day, He grabbed me and sucker punched me real hard. You kind of got used to it.
I always dug John. I just hated his band's music. It was the opposite of everything I loved and believed in. I would bust his band's chops in the press, and then we would sit down over dinner and he'd say thanks, and we'd both laugh. I think he liked to be around a true rock and roll asshole who didn't give a fuck about anything. When they first got signed to Doc, and we were both in Europe, John and I went to a brothel together in Germany. We were in this room with two twin beds, and we each had a girl. We were both drunk off our asses, and I looked up above my bed, and there was this Mick Jagger poster and the same one above John's bed. The girls were doing their job, but John wouldn't stop telling jokes in his New Jersey accent, and I couldn't get it up. Finally, I said, "Bro, can you stop talking?" He said, "Okay," and kept on rambling. To say I didn't get my money's worth would be an understatement, unless I was paying Bon Jovi to tell me jokes, in which case I got a pretty good deal. April 3rd, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:20 a.m. Shot the video for Girls Tonight. We had a blast. I even brought me a little souvenir home. Don't know what her name is. Did me good to get out tonight.
Wayne Isham. When Motley told me the concept behind Girls, Girls, Girls was strip clubs, I naturally did some meticulous, multiple-night research to discover which establishment was the most appropriate. We wanted to use the Body Shop, but that was all nude and didn't serve alcohol, so we ended up with a place called the Seventh Veil. Nikki and Tommy came with me one night. I remember us heading from club to club with a load of strippers in tow. We were in the same mindset on the video. We all just kept saying to each other, "Can you believe they are paying us for doing this? We should be paying them." This was the heart of Motley. They were fun guys, and I don't think the video was exploiting women. It was more of a celebration of them, like a burlesque thing. But we got censored a lot by MTV because it was seen as scandalous back then. By the time we finished filming in the Seventh Veil, none of us were functioning properly. We left the club in a few cars to go to my studio nearby to film inserts. Tommy was in my car with me, and I suggested we should stop off at a Mexican restaurant on the way for a couple of secret shooters. When we got in there, Six was already in the bar, doing a line of shooters. He just looked at us and said, "What are you guys doing here?" When I look at that video now, Nikki's eyes have that droop. There's a real buzz going on. Look at the part where he gives the camera the finger. You know, I think it's safe to say he is coasting there. But I can't claim I noticed it at the time. It's like Hello Slovak from the Chili Peppers. He was a fun guy, and the first time I noticed that something was at all wrong was when he went and died.
April 16th, 1987, Van Nuys, noon. I'm sorry I haven't written for a few days, but things have been kind of crazy. You know how it can go sometimes. Vanity showed up unannounced a few days ago. It's so fucked with her. I don't see her for a few weeks, and suddenly she appears. We don't leave each other's side for, how long was it this time? 4 days? Five? It can't be healthy. But then I guess me and Vanity have never exactly been healthy. So she turned up with this huge baggie of Coke, just like she always does, and we've been living in a blizzard for the last couple days, but somehow I never go quite as insane when Vanity is with me. Maybe I hate her too much to let her ever see me at my most wasted and vulnerable. I never shoot dope or go to my closet with Vanity, but it still gets fucking crazy. Yesterday we were laying on the bed and I could hear voices, people moving about the house. I started shouting, then fired my .357 through the door at them. Of course there was nobody there. It was the radio, and I shot a hollow point clean through my new speakers I bought off Bob Michaels. Fuck. She just left, and as she went, she said the most fucked up thing I've ever heard. She said we were soulmates and asked me to marry her. I don't know how I kept a straight face, so I said something equally stupid. I said yes. I couldn't face her going crazy and starting another argument, and what does it matter what I say? My funeral will come before the wedding.
Bob Michaels. Nicky called me one night when he'd shot a bullet through his bedroom door into a JBL speaker he had bought for me. He was hallucinating that people were trying to break in and the police were there, and he and Vanity had barricaded themselves in the master bedroom in the middle of the night. He called me again the next day and they were still barricaded in there.
Evangelist Denise Matthews. My help could only come from God. None of my relationships, including with Nikki, were capable of finding any kind of love or happiness because I would never look at the root of my problem, which undoubtedly was me. I was very messed up, and it was time to change my life. We paint the outside of our bodies beautiful, but the inside is like dead men's bones. The hurt topples on top of itself until our hurt gets so big and ugly, growing like a cancer worm, webbing around the walls of our heart, which ultimately turns cold and callous and dull of love. We mistake lust for love and pop more pills, slam more drugs, drink ourselves silly or end up as I did, scraping the inside of a pipe just to hit the resin and flush life down the toilet. Personally, I hated every second of being alive in this collapsible body. I wanted a new body inside. I wanted to remove my mind altogether, especially the part that hurt. Jesus did that for me.
Lost lyric, Vampirella. Can't say I'm happy, can't say I'm sad, but I can sigh in relief that I don't have that black-skinned bitch drawing her nails across my grief. Just do me a favor before you draw the razor next time across your wrists. Tell me again I'm your white boy flavor and how we will live in bliss. A little hidden sanctuary only seen in this Hollywood tabloid hell. Living in loyal matrimony, I guess didn't mean loyal to me. Oh well. Vampirella. Now you might as well go fuck yourself, everybody else has for sure. I guess you had to lose so the rest of us could win. Your only fame and fortune has left you, and he's holding this paper and pen. April 17th, 1987, Van Nuys, 6:50 p.m. Slash came over earlier. I hadn't told him this, but last year Tom Zutaut asked me if I would produce the Guns album. I just turned him down flat. I was way too strung out to take it on. It was all I could do then to focus on Motley and staying alive. It's a good thing I didn't do it. I know I could produce a great album for them, but now while I'm on drugs, I'm too fucked up even for those guys. Tom Zutaut had told me I was being considered to produce Appetite for Destruction for Guns N' Roses. I went to see them live at the Roxy, but I didn't think they were all that great. The truth is, I was so out of it that I had no idea who was any good or who wasn't. Fuck, at the time, the most I would have been able to do as a producer would have been pressing play on the tape machine.
Tom Zutaut. I was like a dog with a bone trying to get Nikki to produce Guns because I thought they were the next generation Motley, but more rooted in the Sex Pistols and Zeppelin than Motley's New York Dolls meets Kiss. In the same way that Nikki understood the roles of each of the members of Motley, I thought he might be able to do the same for Slash, Axel, Izzy, Duff, and Steven. I hoped GNR might learn something from Nikki, since he had crawled from the bottom of the dirtiest street in Hollywood, which was also their birthing place, to the top. But Nikki was in his strung-out narcissistic asshole days, and he kept blowing me off and not even watching the video of GNR that I had sent him. Do I think he would have done a good job of producing the album? Given the state he was in? Probably not.
Slash. That's funny, I never knew any of this. It is true that Zutaut was desperate to find somebody to produce Appetite for Destruction who would be able to deal with us. I remember that Paul Stanley from Kiss came down at one point, but we were way too much for him.
April 19th, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:50 p.m. I realized something yesterday, but when I'm high on coke, only to come down and realize again that I was on the fringes of psychosis, I'm starting to feel a real friendship with those voices. I actually look forward to hearing them as I'm tying off. Ah, yes, my friends, the demons. I need to get out. I've arranged to meet Andy McCoy at a club tonight. April 20th, 1987, Van Nuys, 4 a.m. Well, that was a fucking disaster of a night. I met Andy at the club, and he was with a lot of other people. I felt uncomfortable and awkward from the start, so after about a half an hour, I was saying to Andy, come on, let's go. Let's get out of here. Everybody around him was freaking out because Andy is clean now, and they know I'm not, and he's always on the verge of getting strung out again. But I didn't care about that or about anything. I just wanted to get back here. I brought Andy home and showed him my closet. I got all my shit out and said, come on, let's get high. He just stood there in all his gypsy clothes and told me, you've got a habit. You're strung out. I tried to say it wasn't much, but this dude has seen me die once. He knows the truth. Then he left. One by one, my friends are abandoning me. April 21st, 1987, Van Nuys, 9:30 p.m. Pete just called to see what I was doing. What does he think I'm going to be doing? The usual, walking around this mausoleum, waiting for Jason, thinking about shooting up, hating the security box, going quietly insane. Pete was calling from a strip club. He's going to come over with some girls. Might be nice to make a few new friends. I just called Slash and Steven as well. April 22nd, 1987, Van Nuys. 1 p.m. I woke up this morning and the house is littered with bottles and empty bindles and cigarette ashes. It's a disaster zone. There are people laying around, some naked, some partially naked. I walked into the bathroom to find Steven Adler fucking this girl we like to call Slave, and Slash pissed in the spare bed in his sleep. It's at times like this that I wish all these people would go away. There must be something wrong in my blood sugar or my chemical DNA because I can go from being completely the happiest guy in the world to being the most pissed off, angry motherfucker in no time at all. Last night, I could think of nothing I would rather do than this. Now I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
Slash. Man, I remember that party. There was so much blow and whiskey. I fucked a lot of girls. And the next morning, I woke up in Nikki's spare bedroom with some chicks. I was hungover, my shit was strewn all over the place, and I had to be at the recording studio in 20 minutes. Fuck knows how I got there, but I did. I can't deny it. I used to get so drunk that I wet the bed. Nikki's place wasn't the worst time. I remember once waking up in a hotel lobby in Canada. I was lying on a couch and I pissed myself. Then I found that not only was it not the hotel I was staying in, but I had no idea where my hotel was or what it was called. I had to walk around in the freezing cold for hours. The wet pants didn't help.
April 24th, 1987, Van Nuys, 1:40 a.m. I feel like a rat on a wheel. At first I embraced this, then I wanted to get off, but it's like somebody is turning it faster and faster. I fall, and it throws me around, and I just can't stop. We have some time off, so what are we doing? Vince is cruising around the Caribbean and singing guest spots with Bon Jovi. Tommy's playing golf and riding his dirt bike. Mick is content to buy guns and hope for World War III. And six, I'm losing my mind, trapped in this tomb. April 25th, 1987, Van Nuys. 10:10 a.m. This is how low it gets. At 3 in the morning, I was crouched naked in my closet, thinking the world was about to burst through my door. I peered out the closet and saw myself in my mirror. I looked like an Auschwitz victim, a wild animal. I was hunched trying to find a vein so I could inject into my dick. Then the dope went into my dick, and I thought I looked fucking fantastic. I can't keep doing this, but I can't stop. Lost lyric. 26, and I've never even lived. I've been too busy slow dancing with death. Maybe a bullet to my head will make somebody love me. Maybe a bullet in my head would make somebody care. April 27th, 1987, Van Nuys, 10:30 p.m. I sat behind my bed last night with my grandfather's double-barreled shotgun. I had it aimed at the door, and I knew people were coming in. I can't bear all these windows being open to the street so everybody can see in. Today I called a shutter company, and tomorrow they are coming to fit heavy wooden shutters on every window. I'm thinking about going to rehab, but I have too much to do right now. April 28th, 1987, Van Nuys, 10:40 a.m. This morning I woke up with my shotgun in bed with me. The girls have stopped coming around and now I'm sleeping with a gun. Then I remembered putting the gun in my mouth last night and considering pulling the trigger just to stop the insanity. I want to shut my head down and make it stop. Somehow, I've gone from a person who laughs at people considering suicide to a person who is considering suicide himself. Some fucking progress. Midnight. The new shutters are fucking cool.
Bryn Bridenthal. I was Motley Crue's PR for many years. I first met them the day they signed their record contract with Elektra. I could see immediately that there was this special light on in Nicky's eyes. He knew where they were going. He had the whole idea, every album fleshed out in his head. Tommy was just a big cocker spaniel. Mick was real quiet. And as for Vince, well, let's just say Nicky Six was the brains of Motley Crue. I'm sure he still is. One of the early things Nicky used to do was to set himself on fire during interviews. I remember he did it in Motley's first ever TV appearance. I was terrified the flames would ignite his hairspray and he'd totally go up. But Nicky never seemed bothered by that. He thought he was invincible. Nicky was a brat, and he was very smart, but he had a great big hole inside. Money didn't fill it, nor did success or power. What he really wanted was respect for his songwriting. But I spent so much time with him, and I had no idea he was doing all the dark stuff he was. When he was bad, he was very, very bad. But I never thought he was doing any more drugs than anybody else was back then. At the time, I didn't know much about junkies. Since then, I've worked with Nirvana and Courtney Love, so I'm rather better informed. But the 80s were the days that I'd regularly go into a record label executive's office and find white powder all over his desk. Heroin seemed like just one more temptation. No better, no worse than the others. Nicky Six never struck me as dysfunctional. He had so much drive and energy and certainly wasn't drooling or living in the gutter. He hid everything so well. He can dance fast, that one. I guess junkies can just be so cunning.
April 29th, 1987, Van Nuys, midnight. For some reason, unknown to me, I believe I'm not meant to live much longer. I'm dying a slow, unhappy death, shrouded in confusion and questions. I'm confused as to how I've become the drugs and the drugs have become me. We live together in complete harmony. What was once a question, an inquisitive interest, a curiosity even, has finally answered itself. It's a death wish I cannot will away. I cannot or will not escape this prison until I've completed this journey. It ends as it began, with me alone. Like birth, death is a solitary experience. Like Hemingway said, the only thing that could spoil a day was people. I'm the person who has spoiled my life. I've lost all track of time in here. April 30th, 1987, Van Nuys, 5:10 a.m. When Jason left last night and closed the door, I had the feeling he was closing the door on a crypt. It's so fucking dark in here. I feel like a ghost. So I got a hammer and ran around the house, tearing the shutters from the windows and throwing them into the yard. They're making me feel like I was in a cave. I'm not doing any drugs when I wake up today. May, 1987. He asked me to get on my knees and pray to God to lose this obsession with drugs. May 1st, 1987, Van Nuys, 3 a.m. Today I did something I thought I'd never do. I called Bob Timmons and asked him to help me. Bob came over and I told him I just can't stop binging on cocaine and heroin. I think the blow speeds up my heroin addiction 10 times. Bob agreed and said he knew how strung out I am. He asked me to get on my knees and pray to God to lose this obsession with drugs. I wouldn't do it. Fuck that. I won't get on my knees. Bob said he's got on his knees with guys a lot tougher than me, like the president of the Hell's Angels, but he can forget it.
Bob Timmons. Part of the 12-step program for curing addiction is accepting that there is a greater power in the world than you. It doesn't have to be God. It can be anything. But Nicky was always too stubborn to take that step. He was simply too self-centered and wouldn't let me in to help him. That was Nicky Six. He always had his armor on.
May 2nd, 1987, Van Nuys, 4:40 p.m. I've got to wean off the heroin and the coke before we go on tour. I can't go on the road like this. It will kill me. The weird thing is, the coke is the worst part of this, but you don't go through withdrawals if you can't get blow. Smack's a different story. I'm so strung out right now, I couldn't go a day without it. I'd have to take so much on the road with me or have it FedExed in every week, which is crazy. What if I miss my delivery? Also, how would I play? How do some guys tour and stay strung out? I do not want to know. I'm going to quit. I have to. This is going to be bad, but it'll be over soon. I hope I don't have to call Bob again. I have a plan. I've just called Jason. 7 p.m. Jason just left, and it went pretty well. I explained to him that I've got to get clean before Motley goes on tour next month. I reckon I'm doing $500 or more of smack a day now. The coke, I'm just going to stop. My plan is to do less and less each day, and when I'm low enough, go on the methadone and get completely off. So he got his scale out, and we made 30 bindles, each one smaller than the one before, each one with a fresh needle next to it. It took us an hour. It should take me about a week to wean down. When we were done, it looked like a regiment of drugs, a regime. It looked like an army. The brave new world starts tomorrow. When Jason left, he shook my hand and said he hoped I'd be able to do it. Yeah, right.
Doc McGee. Nicky was always dreaming up fantasy ways to kick drugs that didn't involve going to rehab. One time in 1986, he decided that he and Nicole, his old girlfriend, would detox for 5 days at my house. Those 5 days felt like a fucking year. Nicky was just so sick, I had to keep carrying him from the house to the hot tub because he was cramping up so bad. And Nicole was something else. She kept thinking Nicky wanted to kill her. One night, Nicky came into my bedroom at 3 a.m. and said, "Dude, you've got to go and see Nicole." I went into their room and she was putting her makeup on. She said, "I've got to go to a photo shoot." And I said, "Look in the mirror. Who wants to take a photo of that at 3 a.m? She looked at me and started sobbing and asked me for a sewing needle, just a sewing needle, because if she stuck it in her arm, it made her feel better. That was on the second day of the five, and believe me, it didn't get any prettier from there.
Bob Timmons. I remember the attempted detox that Doc is describing. As we both predicted, it was a dismal failure. Nicky seemed to have this strange idea that he could just go to Doc's, sit in the hot tub and eat candy and be off heroin in 2 days. I'm a former junkie and believe me, it's a lot harder than that.
May 5th, 1987, Van Nuys, 8 p.m. I feel pretty good considering how much I've cut down. I've been buffering my itch with Valium and vodka and cranberries. May 7th, 1987, Van Nuys, 9:30 a.m. Tom is coming from Idaho to stay for a few days. I feel frightened about it. I love Tom, and I always love to see him, but I can't let him see me as strung out as I am now. but it's cool that he's stayed close and never given me a hard time about missing Nona's